You're listening to Hire Tech, powered by CodeUp. It's a podcast about hiring entry-level technical talent for your teams. It's where we interview new developers, data scientists, cloud engineers, and the people that hire them. I'm your host, CodeUp CEO, and lifelong developer, Jason Strawn. In today's episode, we are speaking with Dirk Elmendorf. He's the co-founder of Rackspace, a serial entrepreneur, and currently working as the CTO on his latest startup, JobWord. Welcome, Brett. Thanks for taking time today.
See, there you did it. You did it. This is not the first time it's happened where I do everything with my brother, Brett, and people literally call us the other person's name.
I called you Brett?
You did. It's okay. It doesn't hurt my feelings.
Oh, wow.
You did. It's okay.
We can re-record this or we can just call you continue. No. I think we just continue. It's Dirk Elmendorf, which I think I said, right? Dirk has a brother named Brett who are
connected in
all the things you do. Yeah. And so there you go. All right. Well, if you're still with us, this is Dirk Elmendorf taking time with us today, who all the things I said in the intro are true. So welcome, Dirk. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah. So I'll try to call you by your real name for the rest of the journey. And if not,
if it makes you feel better, even my mom sometimes calls us the other name. So I read somewhere once, this is probably just justification, that when you do that, it means that they live in the same place in your brain. And so you feel the same way about the people you're mixing up.
Oh, well, that's good. What I should just learn is the future. I should invite Dirk and Brett onto the podcast. Oh, yes. And that way I can switch names all I want to, and somebody's there to answer. Awesome. Well, thanks for taking time with us today. You know, everybody that we interview has an interesting journey of how they get into tech, and you certainly are not an exception to that rule. And I'm excited to hear some of this that I'm sure it will be new to me. But you've had the interesting position to be able to not only enter a career in tech, but see a lot of other people enter careers in tech and really see a community, I would say, that didn't have a huge tech focus, kind of grow one. And being able to see all three of those things, I'm sure you have some really interesting insights. But before we talk about founding Rackspace and other ventures that you've had, what was your early interest in technology? Where did it stem from?
Okay, so I listen to a lot of podcasts, technical podcasts, and they often have them do their programming journey. And every time I listen, I realize how old I am. So old. Because, you know, like my computer start comes because a salesperson presented to the school board in the little town I grew up in. My mom was on it. I don't know what he said, but they got one for my entire grade, one computer, a TI-99/4A, and we got one at home. And I guess it was very expensive. I remember there was a fight between my parents about how expensive this thing was, and it didn't do very much. And so you kind of had to learn to program something if you wanted it to do stuff. And so that's literally where I started, was like that computer. And when I talk to kids today, the thing that is mind-blowing is that computer had 4K of memory, which is about 2 text messages. I mean, it's just the fact that it could do a game at all or make music or do anything at all, that's kind of where it started.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. You know, for me, it was a Commodore 64. So not too far off the mark looking back from today's standard. By that standard, yes. It was multiples. It's 64.
Well, I was going to say, like, I always end up on these like offshoot platforms. I don't know if that's just my nature or, you know, so I started at TI, and then the next computer that we had, like, I skipped a PC. I didn't have a PC for a very, very long time. My next computer was an Atari ST, which had actually, you know, was crazy at the time because it had what was called a GEM operating system. It had mouse and files and all this other stuff. And it had I used GFA Basic, which was like a procedural basic like system to build stuff. I couldn't afford a C compiler at the time. And so I found that, like, I got access to this. And like, I think like early things I built a Dungeons & Dragons character generator. And there used to be a TV show called Remote Control, which was like it was a trivia game about television. And I and a friend spent a summer building that on the Atari.
That's awesome.
Oh, and that's I went to full nerd. My parents found a computer camp in Indiana. And like you would like go and part of the day you would program. You'd learn to, you know, like I think like the first day you learned like a guessing game where you're putting in you're learning about inputs or whatever. And then you would do like camp stuff, like here's programming, and then here's archery, and then here's soldering class, and then here is horseback riding or whatever. It was it's super weird to think about now that that was a thing, but you brought, because they were so expensive, you brought your computer with you to work on. And
You
know,
that's awesome. I'm going to go horseback riding and create a guess the number. That's incredible. So that's an interesting, you know, intro. Your intro was literally having computers that didn't do much if you didn't write some code into them, and you were given the binary choice of learn to do something on these things to interact with them or ignore them. And obviously you chose not to ignore them.
It's really, I mean, when you look now, it's kind of interesting to see how much that pendulum can shift. I mean, you can be a pure consumer in the AI ecosystem. You don't have to create anything, and it can be amazing, right? But also the tools you have, like, you know, I think I got my son a student license to Adobe. Will give them a student license to everything they make because they want to get them in the future. And it was just sort of like, okay, you have at your disposal the software to duplicate a TV station for when I'm growing up. Like you can take this green screen and make these movies. And he's learning about kinematics, and I'm like, it's just available is kind of mind blowing about what I had to like tooth and claw my way through. Actually, in the old days, to connect information, you had to dial into BBSs.
Yeah.
And though they might be local, but they were all over the country. And so my brother and I were dialing out to all these places, and my parents would get these crazy long distance bills. Which is another weird thing. Like, do they even have long distance bills anymore? Do people get?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Or well,
so
you were charged. For that matter.
Yeah, you were charged for the amount of time you connected, and so they would be like, "Why did you call Hawaii for 36 seconds?" Or why, like, what? And it was like, "Oh, we were trying to connect and find these things." And this eventually came back to haunt me because when the internet came, and I was trying to explain to my mom, "I'm going to send you email, and you're going to be able to communicate with me." She's like, "Okay. And how much does it cost?" I'm like, "No, it's free." She's like, "Mm-hmm, I remember this. Like last time we did these sort of things, it got really expensive, you know." Because I was like, "No. This time it's going to be okay.
This time it's great. You don't need a Captain Crunch whistle or anything. It's going to be free, free for real this time." Yeah.
Yeah. So I have literally like grown up through this stuff, right? Where when I got to college, I thought I might study computers because I liked them. I mean, I liked programming, and the internet was like, you didn't have internet in your room. I had to go to the computer lab to get access to internet, and the web had just started. It was a gray background, you know, but like with scientific papers, there was no place to buy anything. There were no search engines. Like I've watched all of that.
Yeah.
Like come, and it's still exciting. I mean, I don't know. I'm like, I will admit I got more curmudgeon-y about Web3 than I've been about something in a long time, but still, it's kind of crazy to think about how much churn there still is.
It really is. It's kind of the never-ending pipeline of new and fun things, and I'm sure, nefarious things as well, but it gets so outweighed by the new and fun and wonderful things, the fantastical that the internet has brought. So when you did go to college, what did you end up studying? What was your what major did you settle on?
So I have a degree in economics.
Okay.
Mostly focused on Eastern Europe and Russia. I lived in Russia. Like at the time, I really thought I was going to go be like an analyst for the CIA. I had a professor who had an in, and I was like, "Oh, this is what I think I'm going to do." And I went and so I studied abroad in Russia. I was there. So in high school, I went and was there like 2 weeks after Yeltsin stormed the Kremlin. And then in college, I was there. I left on the plane before they knew if Yeltsin would win his reelection and they'd go back to the communists. So like, I was like, okay, this is my thing. And when I came back, a friend of mine had sort of said, "Hey, there's all this stuff we can do on the web that you could play with." And what we quickly realized is like the web was so new, you didn't have to know very much to be an expert. and I'm like, in the Unix world, there's a thing called Unix time, and it goes back to December 31st, 1969, which is way before I was born. And it just reminded me that there were people who have been doing this way longer than I have done it. And I was like, I'm never going to catch up, but this web thing, it's so new. So I built little weird web projects. And eventually a friend of mine said, hey, there's this dude who lives down the street from you. He needs a programmer. I'm an artist. Like, go meet him and like help him out. And that guy ended up being Richard Yu. And like, you know, we're still friends, but that's how we kind of got to know each other and started down this path.
So you dabble with the computers, you're there alongside their evolution from the home PC version of their timeline anyway. And in college, you got this new internet thing there to play with. You just happen to be like most, you know, college kids hanging out in Russia during historic time periods, right? Like, I mean, you've got this kind of unique thing that's happening here. You come back and you get introduced to somebody that literally lives down the street who's looking for a programmer.
Yeah, and has ISDN into his apartment.
Oh, so I definitely want to meet this person. I don't know what wanting to do, but they've got ISDN in their apartment. I'm in. Like, yeah, I'll meet them. Sure, let's go make this happen. And you go and meet this person. And I'm guessing this is the beginning of what becomes Rackspace. And if you're not familiar with Rackspace and you're listening to this, and you are familiar with the internet, you have at some point in your life interacted with Rackspace, early server and managed hosting company in that space. That's probably the best pitch I can give to it, and I'm sure you have better. But this really went from this meeting to what became a household name, multi-billion dollar company.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, over a very long period of time. That's yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. From now looking back, it seems quick, I'm sure. Or at least for me, it does. For you, it might not.
Yeah.
We have different seats.
I think Linus Torvald said, like, if you knew how big it would get, you'd never do it. And I think most people think, oh, I'm doing it because it's going to be big. And I tend to think that the people who get into stuff to make it big often don't have the staying power to make it there. And it just because everything takes a lot longer than you hope it will. Or at least most of the time it does. That's not sure. There's the exceptions prove the rule. But in this case, it would never have occurred to me that I and the people I knew were capable of building something that could become big and life-changing for people, or that could actually help push the internet forward to make it easier for you to do the things you do now. Like, we solved our problem of it was hard to get on the internet in 1998. And now your listener can literally take $5 and go to DigitalOcean and have a cluster in 30 seconds.
Right.
Right. Like the problem space has moved, that's great because if you've ever played any video game, you don't want to spend all your time on basic resources. You want to move up the tech chain.
Right.
And that's kind of where we are. It's the part that is, I continue to find magical of what you can accomplish given the tools that are now available to you.
I love it. The other interesting part, by my understanding of this Rackspace journey, this, you know, as you said, a long time from start to, you know, it becoming something that people knew about, it wasn't kind of like you getting a degree in economics and then going into a role in technology and marketing and leadership. It was a different path. It's like going to Russia thinking I'm going to go to the CIA and begin going and starting what becomes a public company. It was a different path. You didn't go on the outset to start a hosting and server company, right? You had other ventures that you were working on and stumbled upon that, or how did that early fruition of what became your kind of job and career for a while? You didn't go down to this dude's house with the ISDN and go, you know what, we should do start a server farm.
No, actually, like what I realize now is the process I used that happened for Rackspace, I have now repeated several times as my thesis of how to approach this, which is, hey, successful businesses are built around solving people's real problems. And if they can be your problems, that's great, right? Especially because you can know more about those problems. You can know other people. That is the best case. In my case, I ended up having to find other people's problems that I find interesting And so the easiest way to get into letting people tell you about their problems is to be a consultant. Like if you're like, hey, I will solve problems for you. And then you can find some, we call it opportunity hunting in that, in our phase. So for Rackspace, we were a consulting company who was building websites and e-commerce and that sort of stuff. And we kept getting stuck on the hosting, that people didn't do it the way we wanted it. They didn't do it to the scale or the speed or the lying about who was really doing it to the way we wanted it, yeah. You know? And so eventually we realized, oh, well, maybe this is the product. And that is a thing that I have seen over and over again, that if you can talk to enough businesses and see, oh, well, there's a pattern here. The people in the space often can't solve their own problem because they don't think about it as a general problem. They think about it as their problem. But a lot of those are generalizable. And then there's opportunity there if you can pick the right things. It wasn't this like grand plan where we like executed everything. We started with the idea that we'd build cool stuff. And then it was like, oh, we don't want to do hosting because it's boring and plumbing related. And then it turned out I spent like 10 years doing nothing but hosting and plumbing related stuff, because it turns out when that stuff doesn't work, nobody gets to see your product. Now the challenge is in different places. Now it's more about getting you to hear about a product or know about it rather than being able to access it, because the internet has gotten way more reliable.
Yeah, matured. But you know, it's that same, the things that are similar across everybody's journey that I seem to talk to is this basis of curiosity. I'm out there being curious and trying to learn new things and see what's available. And I have yet to talk to somebody that was like, oh yeah, at 7 years old, I wanted to become a programmer. I did it through high school. Then in college, I got a computer science degree. Then I got a master's. Then I went and worked for wherever. And I'm sure those people exist. Certainly they do.
Yeah, there's probably a couple of thousands of them in the FANG.
Sure, yeah.
They're exactly. All working in the FANG space.
That's right, where they get snatched up out of college and go right into work. And you know, you're talking about what I'm hearing is whether it was your journey into programming or into tech or the journey into entrepreneurship and kind of what you've described as what I'm kind of called gonzo entrepreneurship. You know, it's kind of like this, I'm going to go experience the problem of the customer and then solve it. It's super interesting. And during this time, Rackspace hired thousands of human beings, and you've worked, I'm sure, with dozens at the modestly dozens of startups, maybe hundreds of startups, many of which who have gone on and hired a tremendous amount of people. And so I would imagine that reach and experience that you've been able to cultivate is quite large when it comes to how do you hire and grow tech talent, especially in a town like San Antonio that's not known for having a large tech talent pool.
I mean, and then you go to the last one, which is in my current role, all I think about is hiring.
Right.
How do I make it easier for people to get hired? Not just tech people, all people, but this, the getting a job has gotten way more complicated and more challenging than I think it should have. I have theories about a whole bunch of reasons why it's like that, but much like all my previous experiences of like, hey, where is this problem space? Like this is still a problem for a world that says, actually, have I ever told you the Uncle Bob math about developers? Have you ever seen this presentation?
I don't think so. I've seen a lot of his presentations, but.
Okay. So this is, it's probably on YouTube. We can probably find the URL, but when I saw this, it sort of changed my whole view about hiring developers. And what he sort of said was like, okay, if you accept that Alan Turing, 1941, is the first programmer, which, you know, is that he's like, hand wave, that's not really accurate for a whole bunch of reasons, but let's just treat there's one program in the world in 1949. And I think this presentation was like 2016. He's like, there are 100 million developers in the world in 2016. And if you look at how that has grown, biology has a math for this where they go, how long does it take to double the population? And he's like, basically over that period of time, the developer population doubles about every 5 years. Okay. Every 5 years. And he goes, that provides you a very important corollary, which is if the developer population doubles every 5 years, at any point in time, half of the developers in the world have less than 5 years experience. So the moment you say you want a developer who's done a lot of stuff, you have eliminated half of the developers in the world. Then you go, I want you to use this technology for this money in this location with me. Like the idea that you're having a hard time starts from the, oh, by the way, you've eliminated a big pile of the market precisely because there are so many people entering that you're filtering for, you know. So in some cases and organizations, and look, that's totally fine. But when I started to look at that, I was like, oh, I probably should get way better at that because it could be a competitive advantage, right? This is actually how I went on to hire like 8 Coda people because I accepted, oh, well, if I don't get good at this, if I could get good at this, it's an advantage. Like when we started Rackspace, we got really good at teaching people the what's and how's of Linux operating system because there just weren't Linux experienced people they didn't exist, right? And we could find people who you could go, oh, you have the right mentality, we can teach you. We can make you into a Linux badass. And so I've seen this process work.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of a big believer, although I did not account for the world of pandemic, which kind of terrifies me in the world of new people coming on and how hard it is because it turns out remote learning is hard for professionals, let alone, you know,
yeah,
us.
Yeah, we've certainly been happy to see our classrooms come back to in person recently. That's been nice. So, you know, as we talk about this, tell us exactly what it is that JobWord is doing. What's the problem you're solving and the platform or product that you're creating? Or can you at this point?
So so we have a version out now that I can totally talk about. And just so it's going to sound like a sales pitch, but it's 100% free. So I don't know if that counts as a sales pitch. But I left a startup and a whole bunch of developers I'd worked with ended up getting laid off as they kind of rejiggered their financing. And I said, hey, I'm going to help them find jobs. Everybody wants developers. You guys are going to have no problem. You're really good. I've spent all this time with you and I have a great network. You know, I said, I'm like, oh, we have all the advantages. I thought this was going to be like a 2-week process. And then I was going to figure out what am I going to do with my life? And instead, I just watched very capable people kind of get crushed by a system that filtered them or wouldn't respond at all. You know, I literally had people go, well, why aren't you sending them to me? I'm like, I sent them to you twice. You stood them up at least once. I'm like, what are you doing to me, man? And I'm like, this is super messed up. And when I looked at the marketplace, my natural instinct is to be on the business side because I understand it. But I was like, okay, everybody wants the business side. Nobody advocates for the job seeker. And so I'm like, what if we sit there? What if that's the side we live on? And so that's kind of where we started. And so we spent a bunch of time trying to figure out how do we support, give tools to people who are looking for work who are good. We believe most of the people looking for work are actually very good at what they do. They're just terrible at explaining what it is they do. And so, you know, like what we have right now is a system to build targeted resumes to get through the filters because I'm going to give you like, here's the shortest thing you can do to make your life better when you're looking for work, which is it is not about being impressive. It is about being relevant. I have an amazing resume. I've done some really cool stuff. We talked about Russia and a public company. If I put my resume into a pile of people to manage a dental office, it's super impressive and no one's going to call me. And I see people write resumes like that all the time. I'm like, why are you telling me this? They're trying to figure out, can you do this job? Tell them for what they ask. And so we built a thing that hones that in so that people get better at, oh yeah, I can do that. Yeah, you just got to tell them that. And it's been incredibly satisfying to be part of, like, I thought it was awesome when I hired people who were at the beginning of their career and helped them grow as developers. It has also been more exciting to help people who are at a moment where they're scared, they're, you know, like, job seeking, it often accompanied a very high Maslow's threat, right? Like, will I have rent? Will I have food? Will I have healthcare? So helping them shorten that process and get in, it is super bucket filling for me to be Oh yeah, you found your thing. And actually, because somebody actually goes, no, you're awesome. If you explain it right, they'll know you're awesome. You just have to get in the room. And that's where we are. Like, we're in the process of building stuff for recruiters. Depending on when this lands, we may have a recruiting product by then, because it turns out recruiters have some of the same problem. But the world of development, how do I say this? Like, I got to start when there was nothing. So everything they've added at every stage, I just got to pile on. Like, I started web programming before there was CSS. There was no CSS. We've been through you may feel like that's always been there. It hasn't always been there. And I was there before. So I don't think about this the same way. Whereas when I talk to new people, they have, it's like intense technical FOMO where they're like, I have to learn all the things. I have to what things should I learn? And how do I jump from thing to thing? And I'm like, I have been in the industry a long time and I don't always pick winners. I once gave a very impassioned speech to Rackspace leadership about how this project out of Microsoft called Hailstorm was going to be our undoing because they were going to fix so many things. And you could Google it. Nothing happened. Microsoft executed negative a billion on Hailstorm. It was all marketing. But, I'm not infallible, but I also have had a long time to go, oh yeah, there's some stuff I picked. Like, I spent 10 years in Ruby and loved it, but I can remember before that, before Rails, somebody had pitched me doing a project in Ruby, and I was just like, you just want to do Ruby. That's cute. That's not a language. And so, we did Python instead. It's been around a long time.
Yeah.
So there's a challenge here. Like, there's a challenge for knowing what makes you fit and where you're doing the thing. And I don't know, I think that's why I like working with the people who are newer, is that they don't often have so much, you don't have to spend so much time negotiating how much they know, because you know more of a box of where they're at. Right.
Oh, that's interesting. It's easy to define their skill set and boundaries.
Yeah, because if you've just been in the industry for 2 years, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you can't have learned because we don't do it anymore. There's only so much ground you can cover. I just, at Rackspace early on, there was an interview day that here, 20 years later, I still think about it. And I had two candidates that I interviewed, and they were both much older than me, which at the time I was very excited, because I was I need professionals. Maybe they'll show me what the hell I'm doing. And they had been in the industry about the same amount of time. And I'm like, okay. And when I started talking to them, what I realized is the first candidate had gotten into a company and done a technology, and that's the only thing he'd ever done. And that technology was mainframe based, isn't a thing anymore. And now he's looking for work. And I'm like, I don't, and he didn't know how to translate what he did to what we were doing. I mean, it was actually probably plenty technical, but he didn't know how to put it in terms I could wrap my head around. Like, on the mainframe, we did these things. In Linux, it's like this. He probably could have sold me, but he didn't have that context. So, and then the next guy, he had been in mainframes and had moved on to other things and had done all this other stuff. And I'm like, oh, you choose in some ways where you want to stop, right? I guess if you get lucky, if you picked Java in 90 in 2000, or you picked, it seems like these days you picked Python 10 years ago. Hey, look, you can just stay in that ecosystem and you'll be fine. But that's a lucky bet, right?
Yeah.
In that, how do you keep turning all this stuff over is part of the challenge. And I when I look at new people, I don't think they realize that that is what they're signing up for. Like that, no, mastery isn't just this one thing. You have to, mastery is renewing your mastery, because the world changes. I mean, but the technical challenges I have now are 100% different than the technical challenges I had 10 years ago.
But while that's true, the fundamentals stay the same, right? An if statement's an if statement. A for loop's a for loop. The general basic ways that we solve the core problems are kind of the same. But to your point about CSS, Now you want to change the font to blue. You literally just type font blue and, you know, it's done, right? You don't have to go thinking about hex codes or, you know, anything like that. So some things change, but the fundamentals are about the same.
Ah, see, so that thing right there that you said, I would say a year ago, I would have agreed with you. And now, like, I just watched a presentation called Functional Programming is the New Object-Oriented Programming. Like, they were kind of talking about the things we hated. Now.
That's right.
I am in Elixir now. So, like, the things we hated in C became the things we made sure we fixed when we did OOP. And then now, functional people are like, the things I hate about object-oriented, I'm trying to fix in functional. And the guy made an interesting point that, like, really bent my brain a little bit, which he's like, look, we've had for loops forever. I'm pretty sure COBOL has a for loop. I BASIC has a for loop. I don't know Fortran. I'll bet you Fortran has a for loop. Who doesn't have a loop, right?
Yeah.
And when you wrote, like, when I wrote PHP 20 years ago, it was always a for loop. Like, for loops were the bread and butter.
Oh, yeah. And nested.
Yeah. Nested for loops. And then in React, I never write a for loop. It's always a map. Right? It's just way more concise. Yeah. You don't need an intermediate variable, blah, blah. This is probably a little technical. But he was sort of like, there was a time when we brought up map and everybody said, but I have a for loop. And at some point we've started to tip over where people are like, oh, I get it. This is better in certain cases or many cases it's better. And I was like, wow, that is something I took for granted as like a, as you said, like a fundamental loops or loops. And I'm like, yeah, they are until they aren't. I feel like that's actually the secret of all this technology is the details don't matter until they do. And you spend a whole bunch of time trying to figure out, do I hide this detail or do I embrace this detail? And that doesn't change. What is it? If you want it to go faster, remove a layer of abstraction. If you want it to be better, you add a layer of abstraction and you got to figure out where that line is. And spoiler, there's no right, you don't know the right answer till it's done.
Yeah. Well, it's never right. You could have always gone a little faster or made it a little easier to write.
Yeah.
But, you know, while I agree with your argument and I definitely love Elixir, this OOP and functional religious battle has been going on for decades. Functional has been around, I mean, for longer than we have. Elixir's running on Erlang as its VM, which is, you know, the first text message sent by Benjamin Franklin was, using Erlang, I'm pretty sure. So,
but I don't mean it as a holy war. Like,
no, I understand. I'm not
a purist. But yeah. It's been interesting to me to see, like, actually a long time ago, Tim O'Reilly made this presentation where he was like, when you choose a technology, you think you're choosing a technology, but you're also choosing a community. And at the time, I didn't fully get what he meant. And now that I've been through several, I'm like, oh, yeah. I wouldn't describe my, I don't think I describe myself as this kind of programmer. Earlier in my career, I tended to go, the language I was strongest at, that's, I'm a PHP developer, I'm a C developer, whatever. I don't quite think about it that way, but I can tell you, if you hang out with people who write mostly C and you hang out with people who write mostly PHP, you're going to notice that they approach things just differently. They have different values. Sure. They care about different stuff. I'm watching this Rorschach test in the JavaScript world over TypeScript, like that professional developers should have shown up and they want JavaScript to not be a language written over 3 days in a fugue, like in a caffeine induced haze. They want something tighter and better and whatever. And I'm like, oh yeah, like this, I'm fascinated to see it play out for the same thing. Like there's a value system here that you signal. And so I'm not arguing that like the all Turing complete languages are interchangeable on some level. That's 100% true. And when you start out, getting good at one is worth a lot rather than being passable at some.
Yeah. We get good at any.
Because
really?
Yeah.
To your point, I mean, PHP still is powering a significant portion of the internet, if not maybe still the most popular language for legacy applications on the internet. You learn PHP, you're going to get a job. There's jobs available. No, and I think the best part about what you just described to me is the best part about tech, and that there's always something new to learn. And for people outside, they're often telling me that's the most daunting part. Like, You mean I'm going to go into an industry where I'm never going to become an expert, where I'm never going to know everything, because by the time I get good at it, a new technology is there? And my answer is that's been the best part. I mean, it's awesome. There's always something new. When I think about the number of languages I've written, whether I became prolific in them or not is a different list. But just to have written and been paid for, it's probably a couple of dozen or more. Now, the list I got prolific at is probably like three. But, you know, there was just so much technology, the number of databases I've worked with, operating systems. It's, you know, you spend a few decades in the career and you're going to learn a tremendous amount of things and it never ends. You get good at OOP, you switch to functional.
Yeah, some of which is going to be evergreen and valuable for the rest of your career. And some of which is going to be a trivia question you can answer when it comes up. And you don't know which is which until way later.
I love that. Like, you don't know which is which.
Well, I mean, like I used to, like, I take for granted that I spent time managing DNS servers. Like I know or knew a lot about, turns out DNS is a slow protocol. So it has, I don't think it's changed that much. I don't think we have DNSSEC yet. Again, still after all this time, but the idea being that, like, oh, I just take for granted that you understand how it works, so you can know why when you screw up that record, you could be in real trouble for 48 hours or however long you space out your caching. And I'm like, oh, that's just trivia for most people because you're on a cloud platform that sets the TTL to 30 seconds and they don't care. And so, like, all mistakes are short-lived. And so that weird detail I have is much like all the rules of second edition Dungeons and Dragons that lives in my head rent free. It's like, oh, I do know that stuff. It just turns out it doesn't come up that often.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Well, with the time we have left, I mean, now that we've established you've had an interesting journey, you've hired or been a part of a lot of people's journey into tech, and now you're focused on helping people break into that job, first, second job, early jobs in tech. What are some of the key things that you have learned, especially lately? Have you sat in that other seat? And one that you've pointed out that I can pull back up was, you know, it's better to be relevant than impressive when it comes to your resume. And that's super important.
I have talked to people who go into interviews nervous, and I kind of go, hey, like technical people where I'm like, hey, they know they're not interviewing me. They know you don't have 25 years of experience in the web. Like, they didn't call you this far because they don't want somebody who has a couple years of experience. Like, if you get to an interview, they already know that you're not, you know, a veteran or a senior or whatever the term we're going to use to divide that lineup, and just be actually about who you are there, because they wouldn't bring you that far if they weren't open to it. So don't judge yourself against somebody like your instructors. Yeah, it's not the same. For technical people who are starting out, I think, like, look, pick a thing and get good at it so that you really understand it. Because once you understand one thing, translating the other things will get better. When you're halfway into any paradigm or language and you move, you don't get that, as you said, prolific or fluent. You don't get fluent in a thing. And that makes learning the next thing much harder because you're basically learning from scratch again, which can be brutal. I mean, yeah. I transitioned from, you know, C and PHP, and then, you know, like spent a decade in Ruby, and now I'm in Elixir and functional land. And it's taken me time to wrap my head around it. But the only part I had to wrap my head around was what's different from the previous paradigms, not the whole idea of programming and that stuff. The other thing I would warn new developers about, and I've seen this happen a couple of times, is that look at the job you're in and ask yourself, am I being pushed? Am I getting opportunity to learn? Am I getting opportunities to take risks? Like, am I in a child pen where they give me JIRA tickets that are super prescribed and I better not step out of my box? Because I'm just going to tell you, that is not how you learn and become great, by doing little tiny things that don't really, like, you want to ship features, and you may not be ready to do that out of the gate, and that may not be something they want you to be instantly, but when you're in your job, look at whether or not that is on the path and you're moving towards it. They're getting you ready for that, because if you don't, what will happen is you will find yourself a year, 2 years out, And when you go to look for jobs, people will now not think that you're this new person. Now you look like you have 4 or 5 years experience, but you don't. You don't have enough hands-on to be able to manage the kind of questions or the other things that people are doing. And I've seen several people struggle, not in the first job, but when they came, they got placed someplace that didn't help them continue to grow. And then when they went to go get the next one, they're like, oh, I'm kind of behind now because they expect me to know these things. And I'm like, yeah, because you need to take training wheels off and move forward. And there are companies that hire juniors and new developers who are good at growing them. And there are other ones who aren't. And sure. And you have to figure out whether or not you're at the right speed. In the beginning, you should kind of feel a little uncomfortable. You should feel like you're being asked to do more than maybe you can, because that means you're growing, right? Like that's how you don't like. There was a whole study about skill acquisition as an adult. There's a book called Guitar Zero, and they were talking about like this. There's very little data about this because most people don't acquire musical skill as adults. And he's like, part of it is it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time to just pick up any skill that you don't have as an adult. The other thing, like, is once you get to a certain point and you can play your favorite song or a couple of songs at a party, you start to keep practicing that and not practicing a skill, a thing that makes you challenge. You get, that's called active practicing. The best musicians in the world continue to play music that is just above their skill level to keep pushing them forward. That's how you gain capability. And so for software, if you feel like, hey, I've been here a little while and I totally got this wired, that's not good. Like that, you need to get more. Don't comfort at the beginning is not a good sign, because you need to flourish and grow and find your place. And if you get, I'm sure there's somebody who's like, oh, but I found my thing and I'm really good at it. This, great, you're the exception. But I've seen more people who they are so freaked out about the process and getting a job and the imposter syndrome of, am I a developer? I mean, like, look, I'll give you a spoiler. Given some of the things companies ask people to do in the interview process, I would not get selected. Like, I don't know. I took some computer science classes, but I don't have a formal education. I've studied a lot on my own. All my binary trees are managed by Postgres, is my shorthand. Like, I've never had to manage a binary tree by hand. I don't think. I've done a bunch of linked list stuff back in the day with C++, but Postgres does my binary tree sorting, and they're real good at it, and I'm okay with that. So don't freak out about that. But once you get in, don't think it stops. Like, you have to continue. If you want to approach it as a craft and getting better, you have to find what is the next thing I like enough to suffer through the uncertainty of, will I get good at it? And that may mean, you know, it may mean trying to do all the things and being front full stack. It may mean you're more of a front end or a back end person or a DevOps. Like, I can sit in any of those chairs. I don't React has helped me enjoy front end because I can partner with my brother and he can make it look great. And I can really focus on the behavior, which is the part I like about the front end. You know, very complicated interaction is that, now that it's not jQuery DOM manipulation, it's great. Love it. Right. But I also really prefer to be in the back end, and every team I've been on since I learned Make in the 90s, I'm the build master. I'm always the guy who's setting up the CI/CD or whatever, because I like a system that works. And so but that isn't most people's jam, and that's cool. But if you say you're in a programmer, that's like saying, oh, well, I make cars. Okay. Do you make sports cars? Do you make, minivans? Is it for racing? Is it for construction? Like, it's a big industry. Like, push and find your place, because they're all different. They're different cultures.
That's awesome.
That's probably a bit of a rant.
No, it was great. I think there's a lot of great advice to unpack there, whether you're, getting into that first job or that's one in the first 2 years. But, the big thing there that I'm taking away from it is never stop learning in this industry, whether your job's forcing you to or you're choosing to. Hopefully you're at a job that's creating that. And the other thing that I took away from it is, it makes me think about when I'm writing code, the two extremes of emotion of software development. And one is staring at the screen going, oh man, I can't figure this out. I finally found the thing that I can't figure out. Maybe I shouldn't do this anymore. Like, maybe it's time for me to quit. I'm done. I think I just wasn't cut out for this. And then there's that moment, minutes, weeks, days later, whatever, when you do figure it out. And I don't know, it's nothing feels better than the, I conquered this thing I couldn't figure out. And now it works. Look at me. And while we spend most of our career in the middle, I think what I'm hearing from your stories is the best parts are kind of those two extremes of learning something new and being uncomfortable, and then that feeling of accomplishment that comes on the other side of it. And unlike so many careers, tech offers you basically an infinite number of opportunities to get over your head, you know, and get to something harder than you can achieve, and then spending the time to eventually understand it and maybe not master it, but use it and create with it. That's the best.
Yeah, I mean, look at me. And you, the listener, the person, you have some control over that, and not 100% of control. Like, look, the market is the market. It likes certain things. It doesn't like certain things. Like, I spent a long time in Ruby. I really loved Rails and Ruby. I felt like when I spent time in Ruby, it was a language that I could be fluent in that let me express my ideas and just typing flow. It was so satisfying. And one of the things I took away from my last round of hiring stuff was like, oh, startups that start today don't start in Rails. All the people who are hiring Rails were successful in the last generation. You know, Shopify is the big example. And they built Rails, they used Rails and they built it. But that means the new people coming in, it's not really what they look for. It's not really the culture as much, as far as I could tell. And I'm like, do I want to be the badass Rails guy who gets called into those special things, or do I need to go do something else? And that's literally how I picked Elixir. Was I was like, look, I need to do something that seems like it addresses some of my challenges that I had with Rails, but also forces me to dive into something I don't really get. I mean, like, there are definitely still parts of Elixir that I look at after 2 years where I'm like, this is at the edge of my ability right here, and I'm going to have to dig at that a little bit. And, you know, every day what that boundary has gotten wider as I'm teaching new people how to use it. But like, there are choices you will eventually make of like, do I want to stay in this thing or do I want to do the new thing? That isn't something that goes away as long as you want to stay in the industry, because there are ways for you to just stop and go, I'm going to do this thing. And as long as that stays viable, you're fine. But you are trading that security of the moment for risk down the road. Like I'm listening to all these poor people who had their life savings tied up in Bitcoin and have now lost half of everything, or, you know, like just been wiped out recently. And you kind of go like, that's the swings in our industry are at a different scale than they used to be. Right. When I started on a BBS in my house, you know, like the stakes were low, and now it's just a completely different animal in terms of who it impacts and what happens and things that could be huge. You know, you could start something and Amazon could decide they're going to do that, and that could be the end of your day, right? It's different. It's
literally that simple. Of course, the flip side is we walk around with supercomputers in our hip pockets, and we can start businesses now with probably 15 minutes on a park bench and an internet connection. It's pretty phenomenal how technology has shaped so many things. And as you know, it's been interesting to see how you've been able to watch this last iteration of it through the last 25 plus years. And I appreciate the insights, the stories, and some of the things you got to share with us today, Dirk. It's been a lot of fun to have you on the show, and I appreciate you taking the time. How do we get and learn more about what you're working on now?
Oh, so you can go to jobwork.com. It's free and available right now. And I would say for those of you who are looking, look, you deserve a good job. It's not you. It's just hard out there. And right now, that's kind of my mission, to make it so that good people get good jobs. That's the challenge.
Love it. So it's jobwork, jobwork.com. Our guest, Dirk Elmendorf. You're listening to Higher Tech, powered by Code Up. If you like what you heard today and you want to hear more interviews with people who are entering their first career in technology or the people that hire them, please go and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Thanks again, Dirk.